Okay, welcome everybody. This is the third office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Economics of the Great Depression. Today is December 1st, 2012. And for those of you who already logged in, as always, go ahead and type your questions. While you're doing that, we build up a little queue there. Let me just explain to you guys what I was talking about. If you already heard the main lecture for week three, so what I've got here on the screen is an article that Paul Krugman linked to. I think it was yesterday, so it would have been 30 days in November. I'm just saying in case somebody listened to this and wants to go back and find it, him or herself. So, yeah, November 30th. I think it's when Krugman did it, or maybe it was November 29th. I saw it yesterday, November 30th, 2012. And what happened was Krugman, I know him well because I have this obsession, as you guys know. So what will happen is he'll start toying with some idea, some notion, and then he'll just run with it. Okay, so just to give you the context of this, in case you have a life and don't spend every waking hour reading Paul Krugman stuff. He, for a long time, has been ridiculing anybody who has the audacity to suggest that the U.S. federal government, by running massive deficits year after year, might find itself in a tight situation. And so, in particular, if people point at Greece and say, look what's happening over there, investors got spooked. They all of a sudden doubted the ability of the Greek government to pay the interest principal on its outstanding government bonds. So then they insisted on higher interest rates, and then interest costs of servicing their outstanding debt got so high, and plus they were still running budget deficits, that all of a sudden the Greek government was in a fiscal emergency. And they had to go to the international community to get emergency loans. And then, of course, these international agencies and so forth insisted on fiscal austerity for the Greek government. They said, yeah, okay, we'll give you an emergency loan to get you through this crisis, but you got to reform your house there because you guys are just too irresponsible. We're not just going to keep giving you money forever. You got to show us you're getting things under control. And that's why there's riots and stuff there, because they have this austerity package that, in a sense, has been imposed upon them by outsiders, because the Greek government doesn't want to default on the bonds that people already hold, and it must be able to continue borrowing money to keep running deficits. All right, so some people say, oh my gosh, you know, these huge deficits that first George Bush and now Barack Obama are running are crazy. This is irresponsible. Look at how much debt we've piled up in the last few years. We're going to turn into Greece if we don't watch out and turn this thing around. So Krugman has just been ripping those people for literally years now at this point. And so one of the things he did a few weeks ago, in what he called them, is he mocked them, saying, these people are worried about the invisible bond vigilantes, meaning they're worried about these guys that are going to come in the speculator in the currency and bond markets and attack either the dollar or U.S. treasuries. Yeah, John, go ahead. You could just, for people who are logging in, go ahead and type your questions right in the main chat box. There's not enough people to make that a problem. The main lectures, that doesn't work because then it bounces around too much. There's too many people. But here, go ahead. Just type them right in there. Okay, so people are worried about the so-called invisible bond vigilantes, because, of course, Krugman's making fun of them, similar to the confidence fairy. All right, so Krugman has all these fanciful terms to mock the people. Incidentally, also, just on another tangent, if you guys aren't reading my blog and you're interested in this stuff, I suggest that you do, because there I really get into this kind of stuff. And lately, the thing that I'm discovering is there is a huge literature out there about the harmful effects of taxation and Krugman and Christina Romer and people like that for the last couple of years have been saying, like, this is some sort of right-wing fantasy. And what's really hilarious is Christina Romer herself, with her husband, David Romer, in 2010, published a paper in the American Economic Review saying how damaging tax hikes can be on growth and on investment and so on. And then, but in 2012, she had an op-ed in the New York Times saying that, you know, these right-wingers who are saying that marginal tax rates can affect output or reduce taxable income are nuts. So that's kind of funny. But anyway, and then the other thing in that paper is the Romer and Romer, Christina Romer being the former head of the Council of Economic Advisors under Obama, in this paper that they wrote in 2007 that got published in 2010, they say that, you know, they have different categories of motivations for why governments might have changed tax policy, and they estimate the effects on output, investment, and so forth within each of those categories. So they say, instead of just giving you a big number, talking about what happens when governments change tax policy, what happens to the economy, we think it's more useful to look at the categories, the motivations. And so, and I think that's, you know, one improvement of their approach over the previous ones in the literature. And so they find it in particular, so they have this conclusion that when governments change tax policy, not trying to just, not being counter-cyclical, all right, so it's not that all the economy, they're worried about it going into recession, so they cut taxes, or they're worried about the economy overheating, so they raise taxes. They're saying, let's throw those cases out, because that can kind of bias the estimate downward, right? Because let's say the economy was poised to go into a recession, and then they cut taxes to avoid that, and so then it didn't really go down too much. If you just are running regressions, it would look like the tax cut had no effect on output, because there's the counterfactual that if they hadn't cut taxes, the economy would have crashed. So the Romers in this paper say, we don't want to deal with cases like that, because that's going to, you know, the standard regression approach isn't going to work very well in that case. It's going to understate the potency of tax changes, you know, cuts or hikes. So they said, let's just look at cases where, you know, looking at the speeches on the House floor and looking at the report of the president and so forth, let's just look at cases where they change tax policy for reasons besides counter-cyclical economic policy. And in that case, that's where they get the headline result that, wow, tax changes have a huge effect. In particular, they found if the government hikes taxes by 1% of GDP, then real GDP falls by 3 percentage points. So that's huge if you think through what that means. Okay, so but then they had this caveat. They said, however, within that finding, if we refine it even further and we only look at cases where the government hikes taxes to reduce an inherited budget deficit, then the negative effects on output aren't nearly as big. Okay, so what they're saying is if the government thinks that, oh, you know what, we're going to start spending a lot of money on some new program next year, and so let's raise taxes because we don't want the deficit to get huge permanently, that's going to have a very negative effect on future economic growth. But if the government, you know, people come into office and they have a huge deficit, and they say, let's raise taxes to close the deficit, but we're not going to raise spending, then it's not nearly as crippling. Right? And so the mechanism, I mean, that's what the regression showed. Now the question is, what do the Romers think this has to do with? And they came up with a mechanism relying on past literature and so forth, saying, well, maybe what's happening is that there's investors, when the government hikes taxes just to close the deficit that the government inherited from the previous administration, maybe the mechanism by which that's not crippling the economy is that investors become more confident about the future, they expect there to be lower interest rates because of the smaller deficit, and maybe that's why investment doesn't tank as much in these scenarios. And so that's hilarious, because that is precisely that sort of analysis and conjecture that Paul Krugman ridicules as people believing in the confidence fairy. The only difference is, when Krugman's making fun of people, it's politically conservatives talking about, you know, the Obama administration, whereas the Romers, they wrote that paper in 2007 before Barack Obama took office and before Christina Romer was in the White House. And so, you know, that it hadn't been politicized at that point. So anyway, I'm going to, like what it is, wait, I don't think Christina Romer would ever in a million years be caught now, like in a New York Times op-ed or something, talking about, oh, if governments raise taxes, that's very crippling to growth, unless they do it to close the budget deficit, because then that can give confidence to investors. Because it's precisely that kind of talk that some European economists engaged in, and Krugman just has been mocking them mercilessly. Okay, anyway, back to the story. So that's what Krugman's been doing for the last few years. And I mentioned my blog because I'm saying I get into the papers and cut and paste and give you the quotes if you're interested in that stuff. But anyway, back to this topic. So one thing Krugman's been saying lately is, not only are these moron right-wingers wrong for thinking that there's going to be a bond crisis in the United States, for thinking that the bond vigilantes will attack, but if they did, even though I, Paul Krugman, say they're not going to, but if they did, it would help our economy. So Krugman's saying it would actually help the U.S. economy if investors around the world stop trusting the U.S. government so much and insisted on higher interest rates. It would help us if interest rates on government bonds actually went up. And his mechanism for that, there's different ways of looking at it. One way of seeing it is, Krugman thinks that right now the big problem is interest rates are stuck at 0%, interest rates on short-term government debt. So the Fed can't work its magic. It can't stimulate the economy because it's already pushed interest rates down to zero. We're in the liquidity trap. So if now there's this exogenous shift in all the curves, so that with the current stance of monetary policy, instead of short-term treasuries having a yield of about zero, now if they have a yield of 5%, because investors are worried about default or they're worried about future inflation, and so instead of being willing to lend money to Uncle Sam, it's, you know, for 3 months at basically 0%, now they're saying, no, we better get 5% at an annualized rate. Krugman said, that's good, because now that gives the Fed that much more room to inflate. Or another way of seeing it is, that will allow the Fed to inflate more, which will cause the dollar to fall against other currencies, and that will stimulate our export. Okay, so that's a different way of seeing how Krugman can be reaching this result. Okay, so then, now that he's on this new fanciful idea of, oh, you know, a bond attack actually would help the U.S., he says, let me go find, you know, are there any historical examples of a country that issues its own currency and has debts denominated primarily in that currency that is hurt by a speculator attack in the bond market? And then he went through and he said, the only thing I could possibly see is France in the 1920s. And even there, if you look at the data, it actually proves my case that they came out of World War I in huge debt. They started to inflate it away. And then they chickened out in 1927 and pulled back and imposed some austerity measures, and then their economy tanked. But until then, they were doing fine. So his point was, that's the U.S. should do. They should just inflate, and that's the way you deal with your debt crisis. And as long as you're in a situation like the U.S. government that issues its own currency and has debts denominated primarily in that currency, you're fine. So then this guy, so then Krugman links to this guy, and that's what I'm showing you here on the screen, who picked up the argument. And this guy takes it further, and he says, look at, let's look at France versus the UK. And so the irony of all that was, so Krugman was comparing France to the United Kingdom in the 20s, and Krugman was saying, see, France went off gold, or you know, France was being irresponsible by trying to inflate away their debt, whereas Great Britain was doing the so-called responsible thing by going back on the gold standard, blah, blah, blah. And that's why we know that basically the gold standard fiscal responsibility could actually lead to disaster because the UK did bad and France did okay. So I knew something was fishy there because you guys already know from this class that in the 1930s, the Keynesians point to France as the model of austerity in the face of depression, and that's why, you know, that's the last thing in the world you want to do. So it was interesting that the Keynesians seemed to be, that Krugman here seemed to be threading a needle, that he was on the one hand praising France for devaluing and depreciating its currency, and then on the other hand, I know Brad DeLong and those guys, when it comes to what happened in the 30s, hold up France as the poster child of being responsible and trying to protect their currency, and look how bad that turned out. So I thought, huh, that's interesting. And I, you know, of course, it could be that it switched. It could be in the 20s it was irresponsible, in the 30s it was responsible. But so anyway, they did go that route. So this guy is arguing that France was irresponsible in the 20s. And when I say responsible or irresponsible, I mean in terms of conventional wisdom, in terms of the very serious people. If you read Krugman, you know, the people he makes fun of. So they're saying, in terms of what today's right-wingers would think, the ones who wag their fingers and say budget deficits are bad, inflation is bad, you want to have a balanced budget, you want to have a strong currency. So Krugman is mocking those types of people. And so they're saying the 1920s and 30s show just how wrong these people are. And their narrative now requires, they kind of painted themselves into a corner, to if you want to, if everything Paul Krugman has said about the 20s and 30s is to be consistent, the story has to be that France was irresponsible in the 20s, the UK was responsible, and then the French did better. And then when the roles switched in the 30s, all of a sudden the UK government decided to throw caution to the winds and acted irresponsibly. The French switched also, and they acted responsibly, and that's how you explain the divergent outcomes between French GDP and UK GDP in the 30s. Okay, so it's a... You need to make all those moves because Krugman's written so much on all these episodes that that's the only way to keep him from falling into contradiction. All right, so this guy makes this graph, and then he says things like, so the chart below shows us the cost of this orthodoxy. I took Krugman's graph and modified it a bit, indexing GDP per capita rather than GDP to 1913 levels to control for both the human and economic devastation of the war. Gold ended up costing France just as much growth after 1931 as it cost Britain before that. And then he says, the irony is France made itself be more orthodox than it needed to be. That's too much inside baseball. So, and then Krugman linked this also. And so this guy and Krugman think this chart shows you how stupid it is to go on gold, and how great it is to go off gold, how it helps your economy. And the irony is, I could use this same chart and say the opposite. So just look at this thing. For example, look at the chart, you know, the red line for when UK goes on gold. There's that little downward dip, and that's clearly why they think, oh, the gold standard's bad. But if you just extrapolate that line I mean, because, yeah, there's that little dip, but then it zooms back up again. And so if you extrapolate that line, UK growth, you know, by 1928 is not all that much lower than it would have been even if you kept that line going. All right, that's not the greatest thing. But with France, look at that one. So the reason they're looking at that blue line and saying, oh, yeah, going on gold is awful, is they're looking at the huge drop from the top of, you know, the peak of the blue line all the way down. And they're saying, oh, look at that, fell more than the British did, and that's because the French stayed on the gold standard. All right, because what happened, the two stages here, the history, I'm assuming these guys' dates are correct, I haven't verified it, is initially, so remember, World War I, everybody goes off gold, except the U.S., and then France first, apparently, I didn't know this, apparently they first pegged back to sterling, meaning they would say, okay, we will redeem French francs for a certain amount of British pounds, but not gold. And then you can see a little bit later, they formally went back on the gold standard. All right, and said, okay, we will also redeem in terms of gold. So back when, you know, on the sterling standard, that's what Rothbard was talking about when he was describing the gold exchange standard that was in the 20s. Okay, but my point is, suppose I wanted to argue that going on gold was good for your economy. Wouldn't I use this chart? Look at what happened to that blue line. Doesn't that look like, oh, just tying your currency to sterling didn't do anything, your economy actually dipped. But if you go on the gold standard, whoa, your economy is going to go through the ceiling. And that's exactly what happened to France in the late 1920s. They went back on the gold standard, and look at that humongous surge. You see what I'm saying? And then the other thing is they want to say the French suffered in the 30s, but that was because of their foolish decision to stay on gold. If they had just gotten off the gold standard like everybody else did, then you know, they would have done much better. And you guys specifically saw the chart of industrial output where they rank countries in the sequence of when they went off gold in the 30s, and France is the laggard. Well, again, look at this chart. So the UK, you know, on this bottom red one, they got the UK leaving gold, and then all of a sudden, a little bit later, that red line starts rising. And so they want to interpret that as saying that shows if you leave the gold standard, your economy recovers. But look at the blue line bounced up more sharply than the red line did. You see that? In that same vicinity. So I mean, clearly what's happening is there was a huge crash after 1929, 1930, whatever, and then things bottomed out and started to turn around at some point in the early 30s. And so even though France was still on the gold standard, it recovered more strongly than the British did. Now, you keep going, okay, from 33 onward, up, the blue line sinks now, okay. But look at what that last arrow that says France leaves gold. The blue and red lines continue basically the same there, right? In other words, for the before that line that says France leaves gold, the blue and red lines were hugging each other. They were literally overlapping. And then afterward, the blue line goes up a tiny little bit, but then by the end of that, 1938, they're back to being overlapping again. So if I wanted to say not the movements of their economies in the 1930s didn't have much to do with whether France was on the gold standard or not, what would I need to see? Wouldn't you need to see that the distance between those two lines didn't change after France left the gold standard? And that's exactly what you do see. So my point is just with this kind of stuff, if you have a theoretical narrative in your head, you can look at the data and see what you want to see. Krugman looks at this chart and thinks, oh, my gosh, this is so obvious of how bad the gold standard is, whereas I can look at this chart and say, yeah, see, the gold standard clearly had nothing to do with what happened to France. In fact, if anything, it shows you the benefits of credibly tying your currency to gold. So anyway, I spent way too much time on that. But since you guys are learning about all this stuff, I thought that might interest you. And it's why you need to, you absolutely cannot trust Paul Krugman to even fairly recount the history or to tell you what a chart says. So I believe that this chart is accurate. In other words, I don't think these guys made a false chart and put in bogus numbers. But then when they tell you what the chart means, that's where you need to be very careful. Okay, Vladimir says, with the situation Greece is in now, what would be the best they could do to fight the crises? Vladimir, I don't know that much specifically about it, so my answer is going to be sort of generic. I think the best thing, I mean, it depends with all this stuff, but what are the parameters? Obviously, if they completely privatized everything, then I would say that would be the best outcome, but presumably that's too radical, and you say, come on, no, I mean, more than the bounds of what a government might possibly do in the near future. I think they should leave the euro and then tie the drachma, or whatever they're going to call their national currency, back to gold, or to gold. And the way you would do that is the way that Mises talks about in one of his essays that's in the latest version of The Theory of Money and Credit, and I have a Mises daily about that called something like Going Back on Gold. So they would just, they would stop printing new drachma, and then they would say, they would look at what the market price of a pound of gold or an ounce of gold is in terms of the new currency, and then they would just lock that in. And then they would say, from this point going forward, we will only print more drachma if you come and deposit that amount of gold with the government. And so it wouldn't actually be 100% gold-backed drachma, but over time it would approach that. Because from this point forward, any new drachma that were printed would be backed 100%. So depending on what the ratio was initially, that ratio would approach 100% over time going forward. So that's what I would do if I were them. And it would be pretty bad in the beginning. And you say, well, if they did that, they couldn't service their debts. Okay, then default. Just admit to people, you were an idiot. You lent to the great government and thought you were getting paid back. What are you, crazy? And, so go through a formal, like a bankruptcy proceeding the way a private corporation would, if it can't pay its bonds. So it's not that everybody gives zero. Maybe they decide, okay, we can pay everybody 60% of the principal, or something like that. So everyone takes a 40% haircut. And then if that means no one lends to the Greek government, okay, that's probably good. Then going forward, they have a balanced budget. And then if they consistently redeem drachma for gold to anybody who wants it, over time, investors would start to believe in that, and then they would have a very stable currency, and then they would probably eventually be able to re-enter the bond markets once they had proven that they had changed. So people might say, are you kidding me? That would be awful. Well, yeah, but no matter what they do, it's going to be awful. And this at least would get it over with in a year. Whereas what they're doing now and what they've been doing, it's just going to keep Greece in this state of agony for years and years and years, and it's not even going to solve the problem. It's just making the Greek people suffer so that rich bankers can get paid back 100% of their loans, and that's crazy. Okay, Dwyer Williams says, can you talk about the origin of the term rediscount rate, which I understand means the same thing as discount rate? Why the term rediscount rate? Okay, Dwyer, I mean, I can tell you a little bit. I am not actually an expert on finance as it was practiced 100 years ago. And that's part of what we're getting into here, like things like bills of credit, bills of exchange, things like that. I vaguely understand them. I've read about them and things, but it's not like I'm comfortable talking about those things the way I could talk about what a call option is or something nowadays. So first of all, let me just say something. Dwyer, I'm sure you know this, but for the people who don't know, nowadays when we talk about the interest rate, let's talk about the Fed. There's two interest rates relevant to commercial banks that need reserves in order to satisfy their reserve requirements. Okay, so remember, the Federal Reserve, the U.S. system right now, if you're a commercial bank and you have a certain amount of customer deposits that are in demand deposits, so customers have a bunch of checking account balances with you, and let's say collectively they have $1 billion of checking account balances with you, you need legally, as the commercial bank, you need to have a certain amount in reserves, either cash in the vault or electronic deposits with the Federal Reserve. So it's like the commercial bank has a checking account with the Fed. So the actual ratios are different depending on the type of accounts and so on. For simplicity, let's just say it's 10%. So if you got $1 billion in customers' checking account balances with your bank, you need to have $100 million in reserves, either in the vault or, like I say, on deposit with the Fed. So what if you only have $90 million? That means you're $10 million deficient. So you need to get $10 million in reserves as soon as possible so that you're not in violation of that regulation. So there's two ways you can do it. One way is to go to other commercial banks that may have excess reserves. You know, they have more reserves than they need to satisfy their legal requirements. And you can borrow the reserves from them. So, it would be electronic. It would just be the Fed would transfer on its books money that was in the account of the one commercial bank to the other. But if that's hard for you to picture, you can imagine it being cash. So some other bank would literally take a bunch of $100 bills out of its vault, lend them to the other bank, and it would put those $100 bills in its vault and then say, see, we just boosted our reserves by $10 million, if that's what I said. So since it's a loan, there's an interest rate, and that's what the federal funds rate is. So, again, to repeat, the federal funds rate in the United States refers to the overnight interest rate, or the interest rate, and it's an annualized figure. It's not that you have to pay the federal funds rate for one day. It's saying what's the percentage, and then if you extended that to be for a year, what does it work out to? But it's the interest rate on an overnight unsecuritized loan of reserves among commercial banks. So the Fed is not actually lending those reserves. It's one commercial bank lending it to another. That's what the Fed funds rate refers to. And that's the primary rate that the Fed typically targeted. Since this onset of this crisis, the Fed's done all kinds of other stuff. But normally, before this crisis hit, for several years, it was, you know, when they said the Fed's cutting interest rates or the Fed's raising interest rates, they were talking about that federal funds rate. So they did that by buying and selling assets in open market operations, and then through that action, adjusting the total amount of reserves in the system. But then the banks would borrow and lend those reserves around so that each individual bank would have what it needed. So the Fed was just controlling the overall quantity of reserves to make that number go up or down. Okay, but another route by which a commercial bank that needs reserves can get them is to go directly to the Fed. So if they do that, that's called borrowing at the discount window. And so here, and then there, you're where are the reserves coming from? They're not coming from another commercial bank. The Fed's just creating them out of thin air. And the Fed, in that case, also would charge an interest rate, and that would be the discount rate. So the discount rate is different from the federal funds rate, and it has to do with just which market it is. So the Fed clearly directly controls the discount rate because it's the one making those loans. So it has the power to say, sure, we'll lend you reserves, but we're going to charge you 4%. Or if it wants to, it will charge you 3%. So the Fed directly sets that rate. Since the Fed is the lender, the federal funds rate, the Fed's not the lender. Kind of confusing. You would think the federal funds rate would be the reserves coming from the Fed, but they're not. Okay. So now Dwyer is referring to the fact that if you read historical accounts in particular, they'll talk about how central banks would have a rediscount rate in that they would do things like rediscount bills and stuff like that. And so I don't know this for sure, but I think you're right that that's the etymology of the modern term discount rate. It's from that. So I think that's one thing. So I believe, Dwyer, it was something like you would have like an IOU from some financial institution, and then you would take it to the central bank or even a commercial bank, and they would rediscount it, meaning like they would sort of take it on their books and lend it to you, and so you'd have, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it. Let me see if I can. Milton Friedman, when I was doing research for the Depression book, Milton Friedman actually had the best explanation of that I saw. Because you're right, people kept talking about rediscounting, and then nobody ever just walked through the actual process. And then I came across Friedman at one point, just spelled it out like in a paragraph, and I was like, oh, thank you. Somebody walks through this thing because nobody had been explaining it. Let me just see really quickly if anything like that's online that I can send you to. Yeah. No, I'm not finding it. But anyway, let me stop talking on this one, Dwyer, because I'm going to end up saying something that's not perfectly accurate. But yeah, you're right. I think the modern term discount comes from the fact that they used to be rediscounting assets, and so then the interest rate they charged on that, the way they made their money on that, that percentage earning was called the rediscount rate. And then now in modern times, I think because they're not, the Fed now, if you go and borrow from the Fed discount window, it's not rediscounting anything. It's not that you're going up there and giving it one asset and saying, hey, can you make me a loan on the basis of this? And then the Fed kind of rolls it over somehow and endorses it. That's not really what's going on. The Fed just, you're just going up to the Fed saying, I'll pay you back. Scout's honor. And they say, okay, we trust you. They create a bunch of money out of thin air and give it to them. So that they're not rediscounting anything. So I think that might be, this is, again, just speculation on my part, but I think that might be why they don't call it the rediscount rate anymore. But historically, they did. Okay, John D. Rosa says, what does Ron Paul mean when he says we should liquidate the debt? I haven't read like his speeches or his interviews on that. I mean, I've just heard people refer to that, so I haven't seen him say it in the full context. So I don't know if there's any nuances involved. I think all he means is that you instead of us servicing it, just default. Let me see again. I don't want to tell you guys this is what Ron Paul means if that's not what he means. Yeah, okay. I'll try to give you a better answer afterwards. You know, I have it out on my browser now. I think all he's saying is, look, the U.S. government is bankrupt right now. And so what happens when a private corporation is bankrupt? There's a liquidation process. So you know, the bankruptcy court comes in, says, okay, your liabilities are higher than your assets. You can't pay off all your creditors 100 cents on the dollar. So what do? We figure out, you know, an equitable way to deal with this thing. And also, I mean, it's people think that a bankruptcy necessarily means the firm totally shuts down, all the workers get laid off, all the capital equipment gets sold off in, you know, different places. And that's not necessarily what it means. Sometimes there's a bankruptcy, a reorganization, and then the company emerges from bankruptcy and it's still doing the same thing it was doing before. I mean, not the same thing, but it's organized differently, but it's still making the same products it was before. All right, so I think that's what Ron Paul means we should do with the U.S. government, that instead of just saying that, no, the Treasury debt is sacrosanct, and if you lend money to Uncle Sam, you necessarily have to get 100 cents on the dollar. I think he's saying, why do we assume that? How come we're going to raise taxes on people in order to protect bondholders who lent to the U.S. government? Why wouldn't we just say, well, we have, you know, this unsustainable debt situation right now. The way we're going to deal with it is have a balanced budget going forward, and part of the way we get that is we, you know, give a haircut to current holders of U.S. debt. And for sure, you know, all these bonds, because it's not just the federal government's direct treasury holdings, by the way. It's also all the implicit guarantees that now the U.S. taxpayer is on the hook for, you know, because it's assumed, you know, Fannie and Freddie, I mean, the federal government owns effectively a large portion of the mortgage debt in the country. And so if a lot of those people start defaulting on their mortgage payments, in theory, the taxpayer is eating that loss. And so I think what Ron Paul is saying is instead of making the taxpayers be the ones to suffer 100% of all these burdens of these ridiculous decisions that U.S. politicians made, let's restructure things so that it's other people who actually had more to do with these decisions that suffer the burden. In other words, if you lent money to Fannie Mae, if you were a private investor and you lent money to Fannie Mae because you thought they had an implicit guarantee from the U.S. government, since Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were championed as these vehicles for promoting home ownership, and all the politicians loved them, and it seemed like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had the U.S. government in the back court waiting to help them, and then now they've explicitly been taken over by the U.S. government. So what that means is, so in case you guys don't understand what's going on, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would enter the private credit markets, would borrow money from private investors. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would issue bonds. And this was back before they were government entities. They were called GSEs, government-sponsored entities or enterprises. But they weren't parts of the federal government the way the Environmental Protection Agency is, or the IRS is, or the Treasury is. That's not what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were. They were privately owned companies, but they had clearly been set up with the blessing and encouragement of the federal government to promote home ownership, particularly among communities that historically would not be able to get a home if just relying on the private credit markets. They wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't have gotten a mortgage because they would have been considered bad credit risks. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac come in, they borrow money from private investors, then they go into what's called the secondary mortgage market, and they buy mortgages from the entities that actually originated the mortgages. So some commercial bank that's in Detroit, and some, you know, couple comes up and wants to buy their first home, and they just, the various criteria that the bank normally uses to determine whether they're going to make that mortgage to them or not, they would deny them. And then Fannie Mae comes in and says, if you make that mortgage, we'll buy it from you. So we, Fannie Mae, aren't allowed to directly give a new mortgage to somebody so they can go buy a house, but we are allowed to buy the mortgage from somebody else and get it off their books. So now the commercial bank says, well, geez, Fannie Mae is going to buy it from me. Okay, we'll give you that mortgage. And then they sell the mortgage to Fannie Mae. So now Fannie Mae owes money to those private investors, those private lenders who bought a Fannie Mae bond. And the way they're going to pay them is this couple that just bought the house in Detroit now is making mortgage payments to Fannie Mae. I mean, technically they're making it to their bank maybe, but then the bank's just sending it to Fannie Mae. I mean, Fannie Mae is the one who's now going to get hurt if those, if that couple can't make its mortgage payments anymore. So if that couple defaults on their mortgage or falls behind or whatever, now Fannie Mae is in trouble, and so it can't pay its bond payments and return the principal to the private lender who bought the Fannie Mae bond. So when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are getting in trouble because they were holding all these crap mortgages, the federal government came in and took them over. And so now the taxpayers are the ones who are on the hook. So the federal government was basically saying, if you lent money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, don't worry, you're getting paid off. The U.S. taxpayer is standing behind them now. And they did that because they didn't want Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to collapse, and they didn't want the secondary mortgage market to collapse. They wanted to make sure everybody was fine and that credit kept flowing to the banks, and the banks kept originating new mortgages, and they thought banks would be really skittish about originating new mortgages if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac collapsed and now no one's there to buy them in the secondary market. Okay, so that they were doing this, you know, ostensibly to stabilize the real estate market, and what Ron Paul and others are saying is, no, they were doing it to pay off these, you know, rich fat cats that were lending money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So among the other things I think Ron Paul is talking about is to say, who in the world says it's a good idea to give a blanket guarantee to all the people that lent money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Why would we do that? You know, that's part of the problem. That's part of why we had the housing bubble, is because of that program. So why are we going to bail those people out? They're part of what got us into this mess. You know, let them fold. If there's a bunch of defaults on mortgage payments, then the people who lent to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac should take a haircut. They shouldn't get, you know, made whole by the U.S. taxpayer. Okay, Susan says, regarding the quizzes, can they be saved and gone back to, or do you have to complete them in one session? Is there a time limit once you start? If one is not interested in having it graded, how long will they be available? Okay, Susan, I think for the quizzes, the way I set it up is you have to do it within that certain block of time. So even if you don't want it for a grade, I think you better do it, you know, take it, because once that window closes, I don't think you can even open it and look at it. I think it just is going to say it's closed, and it's, I don't think there's a way I can change the setting. so that it doesn't do that. So, and I don't want to email you the Word document that I use, because then, you know, those things can be floating around. And if I'm going to give this course again next year, I don't want there to be a master key floating around. So, not that I think you're going to post it or sell it on eBay or something, but you get what I'm saying, just the principle of the matter is a general rule. I don't want to be emailing those to the students. So, so my recommendation is the two-week window that you'll always have for each given quiz, open the thing up and at least just look at it during that 2 weeks. The quiz, there is no time limit, so you can open it up, and I think that's fine, you know, as long as you finish it within, you know, before it closes. I think that should be fine. I think you can even say that. I mean, have any of you done that? I mean, because I don't take the quizzes, so I've never done it myself, but my understanding is, yeah, you can save it and come back to it. Okay, Rob Gilmore says yes. So I hope that answers your question. The one thing, let me just say, though, so no one's confused. On the final exam, so after we're done with the course, after, you know, the fifth lecture, I'll post a week five quiz, and then there also will be a final exam that will be more, you know, that will be comprehensive, that will cover the whole class of material, and the questions will be harder. That thing, there is going to be a time limit on. So when I post it, I'll be very clear about what those constraints are. But just don't be confused, Susan. The quizzes, you can do them whenever you want within that two-week window. You can open it, look at what they are, and then go do research if you want, and come back and answer them 3 days later. That's fine, as long as you do it before the thing closes. So to be clear, it's not that whenever you open it, you have 2 weeks from that point. It's that when I post the thing, it's available for a two-week rolling window, and then you can do it and complete it anytime in that two-week block, is what I'm saying. But with the final, again, there'll be a two-week window, but once you open the final, you're only going to have like 3 hours to do it. And that's because I don't want people to not study, open the final, look at all the questions, close it, then go and do some research to figure out how to answer just those questions. What I want to give you the incentives for is before you even see the final, you review all the material from the 5 weeks, then you open the final, and you have 3 hours, and it's open book, so if there's a particular detail you got to go look up, that's fine. But I don't want you to see the final first and then start studying for it, basically. I want people to do it as if they were in a regular college class and were studying for the final they were going to go take the next day in class. Because I think that's better in terms of you absorbing the material and walking away with some of this under your belt. Okay, Rob Gilmore says, why did Romer, meaning Christina Romer Lee, you say CEO, you mean CEA, Council of Economic Advisors? I mean, I think her official reason was she wanted to get back to teaching and blah, 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 but she was getting hammered because Christina Romer was the one who infamously was the lead author on that study when Obama first came in and got inaugurated that was talking about the stimulus and how with the stimulus, unemployment will only, you know, we'll stay under 8%, I think it was, and without the stimulus, unemployment might get as high as 9% or, you know, almost 9%. At this point, I can't remember what the numbers were. It was something like that, though. And then, of course, in reality, what happened is with the stimulus, unemployment broke 10%. And so it was unemployment with the stimulus package was worse than what the Romer study showed could happen if they did nothing. Look at how bad things would get. And so she was getting hammered by many people, including yours truly, about that. And so I think it may partly have just been, they said, you know, it's just going to be a lot easier if you get out of here. So, you know, I don't know what happened behind the scenes, but I think that's possible. Or the other thing, too, is, and I'm even going to ask Peter Klein about this, I mean, it's fascinating to see the difference in what Christina Romer was doing before she was the CEA and after. Like I said, if you guys go to my blog, you can see recently I had a post called Romer versus the Romers with a question mark. And I just quote from a 2012 New York Times op-ed that Christina Romer wrote, ridiculing all the Republicans and conservatives who thought that taxes had something to do with economic growth, and saying how, no, I mean, there's just, the literature doesn't show that at all. That's just, you know, a fantasy they're inventing. And then her own work with her husband showed that there's this very strong and well-documented and statistically significant and persistent effect of taxes on economic growth and investment. So the reason I say Peter Klein is he's had her as a professor when he was getting his PhD. And so I was going to ask him, you know, was she actually a pretty good macroeconomist, and then just things got politicized. So, I mean, I actually feel bad for her because she was in an impossible situation. You know, she couldn't possibly have said when that thing blew up and the Obama stimulus package seemingly didn't work, she could not possibly have said, yeah, we screwed up, my bad. Sorry about that. You know, we have to study this stuff more. You know, we honestly believed at the time it wasn't corrupt or anything, but we made a mistake. She could not have said that. I mean, like, SEAL Team 6 would have killed her if she said that. I mean, I'm slightly exaggerating, but when I say she could not have said that, I mean, you know, Rahm Emanuel and those guys would have made it quite clear to her that you are not saying any such thing, even if she had the inclination to do that. So, I mean, she kind of had to come out and do that. And the reason I'm saying that with such confidence is, I mean, I'm sort of involved with these political debates. You know, I do some of my consulting work for a free market think tank that's in D.C., and I just see how these things work. And it's like you can't admit even the slightest flaw in your position, because then the jackals on the other side will just go nuts and point to that and, you know, go get a blimp and put it up on the Super Bowl about, I'll look at what so-and-so said. So clearly we're right. You know, whereas, like, genuine academics who are just having a reasonable, you know, two physicists are arguing about something, you want one guy to say, okay, yeah, you know, my experiment showed this. Now, weakness is there was this result, but I still think that you can't talk like that when it comes to policy debates in D.C. You have to be, we are so right, our opponents are so wrong, and in fact, I saw the devil himself paying them yesterday to write what they just wrote. I mean, that's the stance both sides have to have. It's like they're lawyers. You certainly don't want your lawyer getting up and giving the summation to the jury right before they're going to go decide if you're going to get the electric chair, or if you're guilty, I guess the judge decides. You don't want your lawyer saying, no, it's true. There's a lot of evidence that damns my client, and that makes me wonder. But, you know, on balance, I still think my client is innocent. You don't want your lawyer talking like that. And so that's kind of how these things are. So by the same token, I actually feel bad for Christina Romer. I think she was probably a decent lady before she got into politics, and then she was just put in this impossible, you know, it'd be an honor to be asked, do you want to be the head of the Council of Economic Advisors? And, oh, yeah, you've been, you know, that's, if you, obviously, if you're not an anarcho-capitalist. So, anyway, I think partly maybe she left because she was just sick of that and wanted to go back to doing this research where she could say what she wanted and no one's going to pounce on her. And even this, at this point, she's not out of that cycle, because now she's got guys like me reading all her stuff and putting blog posts up about, look at this, you know what I mean? So she's going to be hounded by that the rest of her life. Anything she publishes, if it contradicts what she did when she was involved with the Obama administration, people like me are going to say, so I try not to be a jerk about it, but. Okay. Susan says, you mentioned central banks existed in the 1800s. Did they have any redeeming qualities? Is there any reason to have a central bank? I don't think so, Susan. I mean, you can, there's various things. I think Jerry O'Driscoll has a paper about central banks. So no, I mean, if you read Rothbard or somebody, they're going to have a very forceful argument about the purpose of a central bank is to allow the commercial banks to inflate more. it's to form a cartel of the commercial private banks, so they have no checks on their inflation. So their ability to build the public, and then that also generates the boom bust cycle. And I think Rothbard's right. So no, in my mind, the central bank does nothing. It's nothing good. But there's also like empirical studies that also suggest that central banks don't help, and they don't stabilize the macro economy or anything like that. Okay, Susan says, as long as the central bank can print money, why should we have any recessions at all? Can't they just dump more money in the system to keep it going? Well, because of price inflation, right? So what would happen is, yeah, when there's a downturn, if they wanted to, they could print more money, push down interest rates, or even if interest rates are at zero, they could print more money and just start buying stuff. They could do helicopter drops if they wanted. So, you know, someone's out of a job, they could just start handing the guy $100 bills, and, hey, he'd feel better. But obviously the problem with that is if they really just kept printing money, and that's what happened in interwar Germany, that's what happened in Zimbabwe, is that they ran into a wall, couldn't pay their bills, they just printed money. And what happens? Well, eventually prices start rising so much that people abandon the currency. And then there's a more catastrophic collapse than would have happened if they had just suffered the recession earlier. Susan says, does Greece have any gold? I don't know. They probably don't have much, meaning the Greek government. And so that's what I mean, Susan, that they wouldn't have 100% backing right now. They could go like go right on and buy some gold and have a token amount, and then they say, okay, well, we're tying the drachma now to gold, and they would just go out in the markets and see what is the market right now, what would be the drachma price of an ounce of gold, because it would be something. And then they would just let that, you know, get a feel for what that was going to be, and then they would lock that in. It's okay, now, from this point going forward, we have these printing presses, or we have, you know, these electronic things based on our new Greek central bank, and we will not issue any new drachma unless somebody comes up and deposits that much gold with us. So from that point forward, they would lock in that market price, and then that's how they would do it. So it's okay that they don't have that much gold right now. They don't need to have that much gold right now. It's just going forward, they would start to accumulate gold as people deposited gold and wanted more of this new currency that was tied to gold again. Okay, let me do this last question here from Mark, and then we'll stop. Okay, Mark Schefter says, hi, Dr. Murphy. I have a question about your book, Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression. In chapter 2, you write that Hoover, in his memoirs, did not make the connection between his propping up of wages and the resulting high unemployment. The English is slightly ambiguous. Did Hoover not explain this connection in his memoirs, or do you think that Hoover never understood this connection? Oh, yeah, the latter. I'm saying, when I say Hoover didn't make the connection, I mean in his own mind, he didn't see that, you know, here he thought he was helping everybody by keeping wages high, and he was telling the reader, so, you know, the bad economy wasn't my fault. Look at all the stuff I did. I spent all this money, I propped up wages, so clearly the bad economy wasn't my fault. And I'm saying he didn't realize maybe the reason for the high unemployment is that you propped up wages. So that's what I meant. Okay, oh, I see I missed one. Last one. Susan said, how does the Fed decide when to print money? Does it ever deny a bank a loan at the discount window? Well, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons, Susan, for what influences, you know, it has all these objectives, and then it expands or contracts the quantity of money accordingly. It certainly denies a bank a loan at the discount window. I mean, it could, just because it doesn't trust that particular bank. That's one reason. Or it doesn't, you know, or if you want to be more cynical, just politically, it doesn't like that bank and wants to punish them for something. But another thing is, I mean, when they set the discount rate, that is tied in with their overall objectives for monetary policy. So when you're saying, would they ever deny a bank a loan the discount window because it doesn't want to print the money to do it, really what that means is, might they raise the discount rate? In other words, if they announce a certain rate, that we're going to make loans discount window at 5%, and then all these banks are lining up to borrow money, and they say, whoa, we don't want to create that many new reserves, they could raise, they could, okay, let's raise the discount rate to 6% because we don't want to inflate that much. So that's, I think that's the typical way they would do it. It's not that they would be turning away people from the discount window and that there would be a shortage of reserves. They would just raise the price so that the amount they wanted to create was how much people wanted to borrow. Okay, I'll stop it there, guys. Thanks for tuning in. And today I will get your week 2 quiz up.